Welcome to the DFA Podcast. On today's episode, we talk about Rays We Do Adore, Yu Darvish's likely landing spot, Akil Morris, John Ryan Murphy, and a whole lot of other fringe players. Stick with us, DFA Podcast.
And welcome to episode 19 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grosnick of BP, and joining me, my regular co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, we are getting closer to the trade deadline. We've got a few little moves to talk about today and maybe a little bit of speculation, but are you excited that there's only a few more days left to go before we get this trade deadline finished out?
I'm thrilled, Brian.
I don't know if you've got the trade deadline blues with all these moves and all the analysis that's coming through and watching the games too and doing your regular reporting for CBS Sports, but it's a busy time.
Yeah, of course I'm used to it a little bit all those years on the TA beat for BP, but I am always a little sad to see it go because it means the season's almost over. However, let's be honest, it's kind of nice to see the trade deadline pass and things return to a sense of normalcy relative to how they usually are this week, even the week before last. It's been busy early, and I guess I'm just excited to get it over with and get back to some normal baseball days.
So we'll cover a couple of what you might consider more minor trades today. It's been a short time since our last podcast, so we don't have any blockbusters to discuss, but there have been a few deals. And we'll start off with probably the biggest move of the bunch, a recent trade, which saw the Mets ship Lucas Duda to the Tampa Bay Rays in exchange for a right-handed relief prospect by the name of Drew Smith. In addition to that, the Rays made another small move, slightly smaller maybe, but around the same size, another one-for-one trade where they traded first base prospect Casey Gillespie to the White Sox. We haven't talked about the White Sox for all of 3 days, to receive Dan Jennings, a relief pitcher from the White Sox, a left-handed reliever. So, RJ, I hate to make you talk about the Rays any more than you already have over your lifetime, but what do you think of these two moves for the Rays?
I like both of them for the Rays. This is a team that desperately needed some bullpen help, and with Colby Rasmus walking away, they could have used another left-handed bat. So to get both without giving up much of anything is a pretty sweet deal. Duda is a well-above-average hitter. They gave up a guy they acquired for Mikey Montauk in January. So, you would have told me then that, hey, in a couple of months, you're going to get 2+ months of Lucas Duda for the same reliever. That would have been hard to believe. And, nothing against Smith. He seems like he could be a quality middle reliever, maybe even a little more than that. But, you have to trade your relief prospects. And especially when it's the difference between getting a guy like Duda and not getting a guy like Duda. And then with Jennings, I know his peripherals are weird. I know he's not really an impact reliever. However, they gave up Gillespie, who has been horrendous in AAA this season, and whose scouting reports were always a little less than sweet. So, think about it this way. There's a chance Gillespie is the third best first base prospect in that system, or was, I should say, behind Brendan McKay and Jake Bowers. You add in how Logan Morrison is having a pretty good year, and Gillespie was redundant. Do you know who they've been leaning on for their left-hand relief lately? Let me just ask you. Do you know who they've been running out there?
I don't. I remember hearing a guy's name, but it was a name that I didn't recognize. So I know it's been pretty dark in there.
Adam Kolarik.
Yes, that's right. I remember hearing Adam Kolarik and immediately forgetting about him, which is hopefully what the Rays will do now.
That sounds about right. Yeah, but what about you? Did you like these moves?
I do. I like both of them. I mean, Jennings is kind of fungible. Like, he's been a replacement level reliever so far this season for the White Sox, but he's not Adam Kolarik. And Gillespie has really fallen off from where he was on prospect lists last year, which is saying something because he was never really high up prospect lists. And I agree with you that with Jake Bowers also in AAA, it's really one of those situations where they have a surplus of guys who probably aren't going to be impact major league first baseman anyway. So why not make a move and try to get somebody else in there to shore up the bullpen, which, like you said before, is not very good. The Duda trade is a little bit more interesting to me, only because I'm very surprised that this was all the return that the Rays had to give up to receive Duda. I mean, basically trading a one-for-one swap with a relief prospect in Smith, who is, I guess he's considered a high probability relief prospect. Like, he'll almost certainly make the majors, but he's not looked at as, I don't think he was even a top 30 prospect on some Rays lists. He's not a guy who's got, he could possibly with a 97 mile per hour fastball end up at the back end of a bullpen, but that's not a likely outcome. And like you said, Duda's a really kind of a pretty great hitter. He's consistently above average. His career true average by Baseball Prospectus is about 300, which he's been hitting about this year too. So that's a really plus offensive performer. Now, he only really hits right-handed pitching. He's not quite as good against left-handed pitching, but he's a real legitimate bat, and I'm kind of surprised that the market didn't bear out a little bit more of a return than what the Rays had to give up.
I agree with that. Though at the same time, it seems like we're saying that about every single trade, and I'm beginning to think that it's not just that these teams are selling for, you know, 75 cents on the dollar. I'm beginning to think it's just a buyer's market, and this is how it's going to be through the deadline. Do you get the same sense?
Yeah, I do. I do, especially for corner bats. You know, there are a lot of teams. We saw it this offseason when we were talking about some transactions in the offseason, that guys who have not a whole lot of defensive value who are stuck in a corner ended up getting smaller deals than we expected in the same fashion. So this doesn't really surprise me that much. I just would have expected, you know, you could maybe get a guy, I don't know who's in the top 20 or the top 15. Like, the name that I had seen was Yonny Chirinos from the Rays, who is, again, like a guy who's probably going to max out as like a number five starter or swingman. He's not a really high-end prospect, but might have been a little bit further up the food chain than Smith. Nobody's expecting, like, you know, Brent Honeywell or, you know, one of those kinds of guys to go back in a deal like this. But yeah, I was a little surprised. I feel like there were a few teams that could have used Duda, and I think that obviously, you know, the Mets had made him available for a long time. So I don't think this was an issue where the Mets were like, well, we're just going to take the first offer we get to move the guy. I'm sure they did their due diligence on him, but the Mets were pretty motivated to move him, I think, just because they needed to clear up their outfield logjam. They want to make some space for Dominic Smith, maybe in September, to get a run at getting some playing time. So I definitely see why the Mets made the move, even if the return wasn't, you know, a premium prospect or even a B-plus kind of B prospect.
I agree with that. And one last note on Smith. He was actually at MLB.com's top 30 prospect for the Rays for about maybe 5 hours. After the Gillespie trade, they moved him to number 30. And, of course, he was then dealt himself. So congratulations to Drew Smith for not only coming into the public consciousness for – about 5 hours, but perhaps staying in there because he was then part of a fairly significant deadline deal if you're a Rays fan. You know, Tampa Bay doesn't usually go out and do these things, so good for them.
And for some more information about both the Rays and this trade, you can look at Baseball Prospectus today. We actually did a roundtable about the Rays and whether they should be buyers or sellers or how much they should buy. And we were doing this in the middle of the Rays process of trading for Lucas Duda. So things got a little bit wonky at some point. But I recommend you go and check that out if you want a little bit more in-depth talk about what the Rays are doing or not. But I would like to kind of change gears a little bit because there was a piece of news that came out about Yu Darvish. And the reporting is sounding like the Rangers have kind of resigned themselves to dealing Yu Darvish. this trade deadline, which is kind of surprising to me. I don't usually hear that a team has made the decision to go ahead and trade a player, especially a star player like this. So it looks like he'll be on the move before the 31st. My question to you, RJ, is we talked a little bit about Darvish last show. Do you have a good sense as to where you think he's going to end up, or is there a place you'd like to see him find himself if he's going to be moved at the deadline?
Not really, but I would note that the reports about the Rangers likely trading Darvish before the deadline came just a couple hours after the Dodgers were reported to be confident that they would be able to land one of the top starting pitchers available before the deadline. So if you're kind of looking at those reports in conjunction with each other, you have to feel like the Dodgers are probably the favorite. Of course, probably felt that way before those reports came out. So, yeah, I think the Dodgers are probably the front runners right now. Do you think I'm misreading the situation?
I read it a little bit differently when I saw that report. So the report sounded like, I believe there were three pitchers named in it, that the Dodgers were confident they'd get one of either Darvish, Gray, or Justin Verlander. And to me, what that sounded like to me was that the Dodgers were more likely to get Verlander as a fallback option out of those three, because the Dodgers are also a team that's very willing to take on money. We've seen it before in the Adrian Gonzalez deal. We've seen it in other moves. And so it seems to me like they're one of the only teams that seems to be a fit with the Tigers on a Verlander deal. And Verlander is, at this point, in a very different class than Darvish and Gray in terms of raw performance. I mean, it's very clearly that, you know, Darvish is the best of the three in terms of immediate performance. Gray is on a different level, and Verlander is on a level even below that. Also with the Dodgers, I see them going after a pitcher like Verlander because of Verlander's consistency and ability to stay healthy, which is something they don't have with any of their other starting pitchers. And I could see how that might be a value to them to have at least one guy that they can rely on, especially in late game situations in the playoffs where Verlander has a tendency to dial it up a little bit. I just I don't know if the Dodgers are necessarily the front runner based on that reporting. But it does seem like they would line up really well for a Darvish deal. They have the prospect depth. They have the prospect quality to go out and get him. But I just don't know. So if the Dodgers were the front runners for Darvish, what do you imagine that deal would look like?
That's a good question. I know, obviously, Alex Verdugo is going to be rumored a lot. I don't know if the Dodgers would move him, honestly. I could be misreading that situation as well, but I mean, who was the legitimate last top prospect that Andrew Friedman traded? I'm trying to think of it. Like, we're talking about like literally like number one prospect in the system or number two prospect in the system. And I'm having a hard time remembering who it would have been. Like maybe Delman Young, if you stretch the definition of prospect. Otherwise, you know, Friedman's MO has always been to deal from a little bit further down his system. And that's the reason the Rays didn't get Jason Bay in 2008. Because he wasn't willing to give up Reed Brignac and Wade Davis or whomever it was at that point. So I suppose I would spin this on you. You said you weren't confident that the Dodgers are the front runner for Darvish. Who do you think is the front runner? And additionally, what do you think the Dodgers would give up for Darvish?
So sticking with the Dodgers, I think it would probably be one of the two of Verdugo or Willie Calhoun. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Dodgers were more comfortable dealing Verdugo than Calhoun, because Calhoun's really kind of come on this year. So that's what I would think. I would think that's the most likely end game there. Maybe another piece. It's a rich return for Texas if they've pretty much committed to not bringing back Darvish in free agency this year and don't care too much about the qualifying offer, which, you know, the qualifying offer situation is a little bit murky right now, but Darvish is definitely a QO guy if they keep him. Moving on from the Dodgers, though, I still think the Astros are a really good fit for Darvish because, again, like the Dodgers, they've got the prospect capital to be able to make a convincing trade with the Rangers. At the same time, you know, dealing a really kind of impact level talent between two teams that play in the same division in the same state might not be exactly the best move from the Rangers' perspective. I don't know if they'd really want to do that because it might seem like capitulating to the Astros, which, very different from last year, but still would be a thing. The Nationals just don't jump out at me as the type of team that's going to be able to pay the big price. I don't see them parting with a Victor Robles or a Juan Soto, so they don't seem like a great fit to me. So then I start looking at the Yankees as a Darvish fit. It would be neat to see him pitch with Tanaka in a team where they obviously care about bringing in Japanese talent. They definitely have the prospects to move to the Rangers. They made deals last year with the Beltran trade where they brought in Dylan Tate. So I think that maybe a deal built around like Justus Sheffield and a couple of other pieces would probably fit. So I'll actually go with the Yankees, I think.
That makes sense. I'm not sure if the Yankees do it. I suppose I could see that fit, but I'm not sure if they're the front runners. For me, I don't know. I still think it's going to be the Dodgers. I just cannot imagine Friedman sitting on his hands and being like, yeah, we'll just take Justin Verlander, you know, right before the deadline. We'll just get his entire contract and we'll waste that financial flexibility. Of course, you know, the obvious retort as well, if they want to keep Yu Darvish past the season, they're going to have to waste it anyway. But
right.
My perspective, I mean, Verlander is not having the year that you would have expected from him. He's pitching a lot more like 2014 than 2016. Just to run off some of his statistics real quick. In 21 starts, he has a 4.5 ERA. He's striking out about a batter per inning, but he's also walking 4 per 9 and allowing more than one home run per 9. It would be the second highest home run rate of his career. And it looks like the second highest hit rate of his, excuse me, the third highest hit rate of his career. The strikeout to walk ratio is just 2.11. I don't know. I mean, he's an old dude. Like, we talked about how, you know, he's durable, and he is. However, he turns 35 next February. He has all this mileage on him, and he's under contract through at least the 2019 season. You know, you never want to bet on a pitcher staying healthy. And if someone's going to break, I feel like all that workload and all those miles might be part of the reason he would perhaps break all of a sudden. So I don't know. If I'm the Dodgers, I'm definitely prioritizing Darvish to Gray and Verlander, which is I think how most people would feel in terms of talent, but I just don't see the point in going out and acquire Verlander unless you can just get him for absolutely nothing, which, I mean, that might be true. Tigers might be willing to move his contract just to get it off the books.
And the other thing about a Verlander trade is the Dodgers don't need to make that trade this month.
Sure.
They can wait into August and see, hey, Kershaw's not coming back the way we wanted to, so maybe we need to get another guy in here to soak up some innings. Or, you know, they can tend to be a little bit more patient if Verlander's the guy they want to go after. But you're absolutely right. He's not the kind of impact starter that Darvish is. And
I just, you know, the Dodgers, I don't think any team is a hard favorite for Darvish right now. I think that's the important thing here. I think it's really going to come down to what the Rangers like in each team's system and whether or not they feel like they're getting the best deal from any of these teams. I mean, they may value somebody like Verdugo very differently than they value whoever the Astros are offering or whoever the Yankees are offering. So it's probably going to be put in the hands of the Rangers. And if they are committed to dealing Darvish, they should get at least one premium prospect back, even though it's a rental.
I agree with that. So let's play a game here, just a guessing game, because we probably won't record again until after the deadline passes. Who would you say, let's just go with a number, how about that? Who will be the highest ranked Dodgers prospect that gets dealt numerically? So like if you want to say like they'll trade the top 5 prospect, that's fine. You can say the 7th prospect, 10th prospect, the 14th prospect, whatever. We can use MLB.com's list, BP's, it makes no difference to me. Just what would you say numerically will be the highest prospect dealt by the Dodgers at the deadline?
So I'm going to take a quick look at the Dodgers top 10 list.
Yeah, just to read MLB.com's, they have Buehler at number 1, Verdugo at 2, Alvarez at 3, Calhoun at 4, Kendall at 5, Diaz at 6, White at 7, Ruiz at 8, Smith at 9, and Brock Stewart at 10.
I would say probably one of the top 3 goes.
Interesting.
I do think that'll be the kind of move that they would make. You know, according to BP's top 10, they've already traded 2 of their top 3. That's not true. They traded away one of them. Cody Bellinger was promoted.
Yeah.
So Alvarez, Verdugo, Buehler. I don't see Buehler getting traded because of his injury issues or anything like that, but I don't see the team feeling like they absolutely must hold on to somebody like him, even though, you know, an injured pitcher is kind of a Dodgers thing. But I could certainly see them dealing one of Alvarez or Verdugo or even Diaz in the right deal, just to kind of really strike while the iron's hot and get over the hump that they haven't been able to pass in the last few seasons. What do you think?
I'm going to go – I'll say they deal a top five guy. I am not convinced it's going to be top three.
Well, I mean, that's fair. Like you said, Friedman doesn't tend to deal a lot of top prospects, but – you know, again, I had forgotten about Jose De Leon, who was considered a high up there prospect.
That's true. It was funny because a few days ago, I believe Brian Dozier hit a ball to Logan Forsythe, thus completing the cycle of De Leon, cycle of a lion. So
definitely absolutely a weird occurrence. I definitely think if the Dodgers could do that back, they would have much rather gotten Dozier out of that deal, don't you think?
Probably, yeah, but I feel like that would be true of the Rays as well. They would have liked to have gotten something more than De Leon because he is just disappointed, health-wise and stuff-wise.
Yeah.
But from one disappointing youngster to a youngster who never disappoints us, I believe it's time for our batting practice session. And Sean, you want to check in here and start giving us some moves?
Am I the youngster that never disappoints?
You are the youngster who never disappoints, other than when you let your cat drive. I know that cat doesn't have a license, Brody. Get that cat a license before you let it behind the wheel.
He's got to learn somehow. We're all trained before we had license.
No comment.
Our first big move of the day, Pat Neshek traded to the Colorado Rockies for infielder Jose Gomez, right-handed pitcher and resident glasses haver J.D. Hammer, and right-handed pitcher Alejandro Requena. So do we like this move by the Phillies that they're going to get another slider pitcher?
I like it for the Rockies foremost. And this is the deal that came to mind when I said that it seems like a buyer's market, because Neshek was arguably the top relief pitcher available. And the guys they have back, Addison Reed, sure, and Matt Stanstad. But, you know, Neshek had performed really well. He's obviously a rental. However, of the three the Rockies got back, the highest ceiling seems to belong to Gomez, who seems like a utility infielder. So, good deal for the Rockies. You know, Neshek should take some weight off McGee and Holland. And it's fun to see the Colorado Rockies buying. And not just buying the buy, but buying to fill a need and doing it in a smart way. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think this is a great trade for the Rockies. I mean, for the Phillies, too, because they had to swap Neshek out because there was no point in keeping him around after the deadline. And they got a couple of different players instead of getting kind of a premium guy who probably wasn't there. But again, it's a rental. So that's probably why the market wasn't there. I don't have a problem with this deal from the Phillies perspective, even if they don't get a real impactful player from it, because it was a move they had to make.
I agree with that. Yeah, I would just note that they got Neshek for basically nothing. So to get, you know, a few lottery tickets that they seem to like, that's a good step up, and it was a good use of their financial flexibility to acquire Neshek in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I definitely feel like this is a win-win, kind of the same way the Duda deal was kind of a win-win. You know, when you deal with some of these rental guys, it's hard to lose the trade on either side, I feel like. You know, if one of these guys that the Phillies picked up turns into – you know, a really solid major league regular, then yeah, then they'll win this trade. But the likelihood of that happening is small enough that the Rockies definitely improved their bullpen by acquiring him. He's a different look than the other guys that are in their bullpen, because Neshek is kind of a different look than everybody. So that's going to be, I think, really effective for them. And when Greg Holland comes back, that's a pretty decent back of the bullpen. I would be excited for him.
I agree.
So you said he's a different look. I'm going to take a bit of a different angle. The Rockies have thrown the most sliders in all of the National League. The second place team, the Philadelphia Phillies. So just stealing sliders away, they really want that crown, right?
Yeah, that's very
the important thing to the Rockies right now, is to get that crown.
Yeah.
So our next move will stay in the National League. John Ryan Murphy traded to the Diamondbacks for left-handed pitcher Gabriel Moya. So, I mean... it's one of two things. Do the Diamondbacks want to control all of your backup catchers, or do they just want to control all of your Twins' backup catchers?
The Diamondbacks are kind of interesting because their catching situation has been so weird over the last few years. And acquiring John Ryan Murphy is not a great way to fix your catching situation. I mean, Chris Iannetta didn't really work out. Jeff Mathis was never really intended to work out. He was never going to hit, but I think he's made a difference in terms of his defense for this team. Chris Herman exists. We're not entirely sure why on some level. So Murphy looks to me like he's going to just be depth, maybe in Reno for a little while, where the team already had Hank Conger. So it's a weird situation with going to get him. However, they didn't really give up anything to get him. I just don't see this as really addressing a need of any kind. It's more of just the team is looking to get an insurance policy, and the Twins obviously have no more need for John Ryan Murphy after acquiring Anthony Recker, which is kind of saying something in itself about how far Murphy's stock has fallen since he came over for as part of that Aaron Hicks trade.
Yeah, but I like this deal for the Diamondbacks because, you know, it wasn't long ago we were talking about Murphy as a potential second division starter or at least a quality backup. And, you know, he's only 26 years old. He's an outstanding framer. I mean, if you look at BP stats for this season, he's already generated 18 runs. Last season, he generated more than 20 between AAA and the majors. So he has that going for him. I mean, had you even heard of Moya before this trade? Because I had not, I'll be honest with you. Yeah, so why not add Murphy to the depth chart? I know he hadn't hit well in AAA for Minnesota. We're talking 222, 298, 330. However, it wasn't long ago that with the Yankees, he looked like a roughly league average hitter. And maybe he won't get back to that. Maybe it's just a small sample. Maybe it just shows Girardi finding good matchups for him. However, I don't mind this. See if he has something to offer. See if he just didn't like Minnesota or Minnesota's coaching or whatever you want to blame it on there. And it wouldn't surprise me if he turns into a decent backup again.
Yeah, I don't think that would be that surprising. The one thing I'd like to see the Diamondbacks do, the Diamondbacks are kind of in an interesting situation here because I feel like there's only kind of a couple of places where they need to improve at this point. Like, as far as deadline deals go, they got J.D. Martinez, and that was the big one. But I would like to see them get an infielder who could hit a little bit, and I'd like to see them improve their bullpen. And, you know, they don't have a whole lot of areas in which I think they need to improve, but it would be nice to see them make a move like that so that they can, you know, shore up those small weaknesses that they have and really kind of solidify their spot in the wild card.
Yeah, they definitely need to go out and get at least one reliever, maybe two even. You know, it just depends on what exactly the marketplace looks like.
Well, the hot new thing in trading for relievers is getting multiple relievers at once. I mean, you saw that with the Nationals trade, you saw that with the Yankees trade, you saw that with what was the other one that the Royals acquiring the Padres. Yeah. So, you know,
maybe. So what you're saying is Addison Reed and Jerry Blevins are coming to Arizona very soon.
I mean, that would be a pretty solid return. Those are two very, very good relievers that they could pick up, but I don't know that the Diamondbacks have the will to trade their. I mean, they would probably have to give up somebody like Domingo Leyba or Anthony Banda to make that deal, and it just doesn't seem like the type of move that the Diamondbacks would make, even in this new regime. I think they would probably not want to give up talent of that level to try to get those two relievers.
So the rumor of the night on Thursday night was that Brandon Kinstler was somebody that the Twins were looking to move. The Diamondbacks were a team interested. Do you think they would go out and make that move?
Well, sure. Kinstler's a very different type of relief pitcher than Reed or Blevins. I mean, Kinstler isn't really that good. He's a guy who doesn't strike anybody out. He's a ground ball reliever. And, you know, while that's very useful for a lot of teams, especially in their bullpen, especially if they need to give people a different look, I mean, the return on Kinstler, that would be a perfect deal for the Diamondbacks because they probably wouldn't have to give up very much.
Yeah, and he's a free agent at season's end, so maybe you look at the Pat Neshek deal and downgrade it 10%, 20%, whatever you want to say, or the Dan Jennings deal even, although I know Jennings has more team control, but, you know, that's another situation of a guy who historically has not had the best peripherals, historically is a ground ball pitcher, and historically has a better ERA than you would think, so I could see Something similar to that. Whatever the Diamondbacks equivalent of Casey Gillespie is, I suppose, but actually a little worse because of the team control situation. So, yeah, we're talking, you know, some really non-valued prospects here.
Yeah, Socrates Brito or, I don't know, somebody, an arm, just any arm or something like that.
Man, literally just the arm that they had, you know, lying around near the boxes. It's like the Harry Potter manuscript laying around the drugstore the whole time. You know who would be, I mean, I'm just looking at their list now and, you know, Jimmy Sherfi, I don't, that seems like too much because, you know, in theory he could, oh, Victor Reyes is still around. That's good. I don't know if y'all remember Victor Reyes, but he used to get wrote up by Ethan Persa because of his big feet. So maybe they just get one of Victor Reyes's huge feet and they're like, here you go, you know.
Stranger things have happened, and stranger things have happened in Arizona, so don't rule it out.
So we're going to, again, stick in the National League. Eric Fetty called up for the Washington Nationals, and he's going to start on Saturday. So is this just a ham-fisted attempt by the Nationals to not go out and make a big move and just say, oh, we'll keep this in-house, even though Fetty, I mean, you're not supposed to scout the stat line, but Fetty has a 5.57 ERA, a 6.43 K9, 1.29 walk per 9, and a 1.29 home run per 9 in 21 innings in AAA this year. So is this just them trying to do whatever they can to not go out and make a big move?
Brody, they're starting Edwin Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah, like this is, you know, maybe a continuation of that, but I don't think this is the most egregious example of the Nationals preferring to play it safe, at least for the time being. You know, Mike Rizzo, I just read The Grind, and one of my, well, the favorite quote of the book is when Rizzo's like, he's talking about the Eduardo Cabrera trade from a few years ago. I mean, the exact quote is something like, Sabermetrics was telling me, no, this is a bad idea. And in my head, I'm like, Mike, this is a great idea. And, you know, Rizzo's a bit of a gunslinger. I could see him going out and making a deal we didn't suspect he would make. At the same time, I don't mind them giving Fetty a look. You know, the rotation's taking a couple hits now with Strasburg out, with Ross out for the season. Roark has not been as good as they would have hoped. So, sure, give one of your top prospects a look, a former first-round pick, and hope that, you know, you can find some more results there than, you know, his AAA line suggests. Of course, again, they're starting Edwin Jackson, so you could argue that Fetty is, at worst, the fourth-best starter in the rotation right now.
Yeah, I definitely agree that this is not significant in terms of the Nationals not wanting to make a move. I think no matter what, the Nationals probably want to make a move to get a starter. I don't think Fetty plays into that at all. He hasn't been so lights out in AAA that they're like, oh, yeah, we just got to make room for this guy in the rotation. The thing that honestly surprises me a little bit is something Jarrett Seidler talked about on one of the episodes of the For All You Kids Out There podcast at BP Mets, and that's that the Nationals wouldn't have tried Fetty out in a short-term relief role for this team, especially prior to their acquisition of Doolittle and Madsen, but even now they need relief help. And Fetty is one of those guys who could probably benefit a lot from a move to the bullpen, even if it's just a temporary one. So it's just one of those things where I think the Nationals have too many pitching needs, and he's not going to likely stay with the rotation if they go to the playoffs. He's not likely going to prevent them from acquiring another pitcher because they need another pitcher. The best case scenario is him replacing Edwin Jackson in that rotation, and that's probably still something that the Nationals aren't super, super thrilled about. So it's cool. It'll be fun to see him. I hope he has some success at the major league level. But, yeah, I don't know that this is a big deal for anyone other than Eric Fetty.
I agree with that. And, yeah, maybe they try him out in major leagues here, see how the stuff plays against big league bats, and then transition him to the bullpen later in the year. So I don't think it's – I guess I suppose it's a little surprising that they hadn't done that, but I don't think it's necessarily a given that they won't try that going forward this year.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And if you're going to do one before the other, it's probably better to keep him as a starter until you know that you don't need him as a starter, because then you don't have to go through the process of stretching him out. You know, just to use an example, we had talked about Archie Bradley perhaps moving to the rotation to cover for some of the Diamondbacks' injuries. Well, the problem is you'd have to stretch him out. You'd have to find a way to get him to work multiple innings. And during a season, especially when you need the pitcher on your big league roster, it's tougher to do that than – you know, during spring when you can say, you know what, you're going to start maybe at the end of the year, we'll shift you to the relief role and go from there. So, yeah, I think if you're going to do one or the other, it makes sense to go this route, even if it delays us being like, well, Daddy was an answer to those bullpen problems after all. So, yeah, I think this is totally fine.
That's a really good point. I feel strongly about giving pitchers every possible opportunity to succeed as a starter before moving them to the bullpen. It's just that with the Nationals and, you know, how I've stated before, I really think they're more of a win now team. They really need to push to strike while the iron's hot in the next year or two, that maybe I would be able to be convinced to be a little bit more aggressive with moving a guy to the bullpen in that case. But you're absolutely right. In the long term, you know, got to give him the shot to be a successful starter because, you know, that's so much more valuable to a team long term.
I would agree that it makes sense for them to give Fetty a chance in the bullpen. I would also say that it's not necessarily a bad thing for a pitcher's development to spend some time in the bullpen. Look at the Indians. They've done this with Carrasco and Bauer and even Salazar. And, you know, the results weren't always outstanding. However, I do think there's something to be said about simplifying your approach. And I understand that Fetty is not like an elite 1-2 punch guy where, you know, his fastball is double plus or his slider is double plus, and spending some time in the bullpen and getting back to his strengths is something that he necessarily has to do. However, it wouldn't surprise me if he goes to the bullpen at some point this season and maybe takes a lesson that he can fly to starting. Of course, the risk is he's Wade Davis and he cannot actually make that transition back to the rotation in a way that makes it worth the while, but I'd be willing to give it a shot, and I think the Nationals will give that a shot at some point this season.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. I think that, you know, the Nationals are just a really interesting team at this point in the season. I'm really kind of looking forward to seeing what they manage to do.
So we got two more for you. Brett Anderson was DFA'd by the Cubs, and it's really a sad story, right? Like, this is one of the guys they thought would help them with the back end. Brett Anderson's always had this talent, but he's always been plagued by injuries. And do we think that he'll find somewhere else to play? Do we think that we're nearing the end of Brett Anderson's career?
I think both of those things can be true. You know, he's not yet 30. However, I mean, I really don't know how the Dodgers got 31 starts out of him in 2015, because if you go back to his rookie season, which was 2009, here are his starts, major league starts, excuse me, by season. 30 in 2009, and then 19, 13, 6, 5, 8, 31, 3, and 6. I mean, you're talking about a dude who has made fewer than 10 starts in every single season since 2012, except for 2015. Will he get another opportunity? Yep. It's possibly going to be in relief, I would feel like. I mean, at this point, you know, you cannot guarantee him a rotation spot. You can't really even count on him to give you half a season's of work. So move him to the bullpen, see if he can stay healthier that way. It's not a given, but it's worth a look, I suppose, because for the most part, when he's been healthy, he's been a really effective pitcher. I just don't think it's worth chasing the dream anymore that he's going to be able to stick in a rotation for more than a handful of starts per season.
Yeah, Anderson has looked so hittable in the last couple of years that I just don't think he's tenable in a rotation anymore, just like you're saying. And I'm not entirely sure it's entirely a health issue. At this point, I think he could get a benefit from his stuff by moving into the bullpen. Maybe he can get a bump to his walk rate, which has been really tough over the last couple of years. And a left-handed relief pitcher who can get ground balls is a decent asset to have in a bullpen. But, yeah, I see him as like a minor league contract guy this offseason. He'll get picked up by somebody for sure. I do hope he has some success out of the bullpen, because his time as a starter has got to be done, I think.
I agree with that. And, you know, left-handed reliever who gets ground balls sounds like Dan Jennings, right? So maybe one day he will be traded for a Casey Gillespie equivalent.
A man can dream.
So we have one final one for you. I guess it's a combination of two. The Atlanta Braves sent down Dansby Swanson and Aaron Blair. And with Swanson, he started out the month all right. He had two hits on July 1st, but then really just spiraled out of control. He batted 050, 156, 050 from July 2nd to July 24th. And it really just matched his entire season, where he struggled heavily. And, I mean, his last outing before he was optioned down, he was 2-for-4 with a double and scored twice. But, I mean, surely Swanson isn't just going to be a glove-only guy, right? Like, surely he's got a higher ceiling than what we're seeing?
Well, yeah. Of course he's got a higher ceiling.
I would just say that, you know, his struggles have been such that he was tied for the third worst OPS plus when he was sent down. That's among batters with more than 300 plate appearances this season. So he had been horrendous. I mean, I think the Braves management sort of ran into an issue here beyond his performance, though. And that's that manager Brian Snicker kept playing Johan Camargo over Swanson. And to Camargo's credit, you know, he's hit well in his 53-game cameo. We're talking 305, 325, 477. He's not likely to continue hitting like that, especially with regards to his slugging percentage. But it seemed like Snicker was sort of, let's just say, putting the team's short-term outlook ahead of the long-term benefits here of playing Swanson every day. So if you're Braves front office, you want Swanson playing every day. You want him to get a chance to work out the kinks and get back to being good. So you kind of had to tell Snicker, hey, play Swanson over Camargo and potentially risk a little bit of a clubhouse issue because, you know, nobody likes it when the supposed golden child is above the rest of the clubhouse. Because, you know, if it's Adonis Garcia hitting like Anthony Swanson, he's getting benched. If it was Brandon Phillips playing like Swanson, he would have been released. So to that extent, I get it. However, it seemed like the management decided, hey, let's just send him down, get him some time in AAA so he can work through his slump, and hopefully he'll rejoin the roster in, you know, 3 weeks, be a much better player for it. And in the interim, we reward Camargo for hitting 300 plus over his first, you know, 50-something games in the majors.
Yeah, the Camargo situation is what makes this so interesting to me. Like, Swanson's interesting because he's never played in AAA before. So sending him down to AAA is kind of an interesting thing for them to do because, you know, he's never had that experience with this franchise. He went straight from AA to the majors last year. If I think that Swanson has been bad enough that makes this demotion okay, even with the presence of Camargo. But if he had been just slightly better, I think that this would have been a tough sell. And I definitely think that the timing of it was actually bad. Because the main reason you want to send him to AAA isn't because you think he's got a whole lot to work on as a hitter, I don't think. I think it's so that you can get his confidence up. And if you're being benched for Johan Camargo, you're not going to get your confidence up. But then to do it after he finally has kind of like a breakout game where he goes 2-for-4, that's not necessarily the timing I would have liked to see on a move like this. You know, if you're the Braves, your number one absolute priority has to be long term and making sure that Dansby Swanson is capable, happy, and able to produce at the major league level long term. And the Camargo thing makes it harder to imagine that might be the case. But I mean, it doesn't seem like he's just completely broken. It seems like he's going through a very, very bad stretch. It seems like he may want to work on his mechanics. It seems like he may want to work on, you know, getting his head right. So a AAA stint isn't that big of a deal. But I really wouldn't be surprised at all if he comes into spring training next year, he hits well, and he's, you know, back to hitting sixth or second or something in the Braves lineup to start 2018.
I agree with that. And I just want to talk about Camargo a little bit. I remember writing him up as a prospect for the annual. His power numbers this season just blew me away. Between it's about 300 plate appearances between AAA and the majors, and his slugging percentage is like legitimately pushing 500. In the minors, he hit 311, 353, 500. Before this season, his highest slugging percentage outside of like rookie ball was 397. Otherwise, it was 326 and 319. This is not a dude who you would suspect would hit for any power. Of course, at the same time, he's walking in. This is AAA plus majors. He's walking in 4% of his plate appearances this year and striking out 19% of the time. So he basically has to hit for the power because he's not going to steal bases. He's not that kind of a ball player. So that's interesting to me that he's hitting for power over 300 plate appearances, because I looked at that slugging percentage in the majors and I was like, that's not going to last. And I know the average is, you know, keeping his slugging higher than it would have been if he was hitting, you know, 250 or whatever, but I still would not have suspected that Johan Camargo would have an ISO pushing 180 in the majors over any length of time, let alone, you know, close to 300 plate appearances between the majors and AAA.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a pretty surprising number. I wouldn't bet on it continuing, but hey, you know, you never know. The ball is potentially juiced, and there have been plenty of guys where I haven't suspected that their performance will continue. He's going to regress, but maybe he won't regress that much, and maybe he's actually a useful utility infielder, you know, beyond what the expectation might have been for.
I would like to think so, because Camargo is a very fun name to say.
So I do want to ask y'all a question in terms of Dansby Swanson's service time, because I know this wasn't the reason you're doing it, but if you look at it, he had 47 days of service time last year. He's accrued 116 this year, so that means he's sitting somewhere around 143 or 163. He's sitting at 163 days right now. There's 67 days left in the season. Do you think that he will not get to a year? Do you think that he's not going to play nine more games?
I think he's going to get over a year, and I would just remind people that this came up earlier in the year when the Reds sent down Amir Garrett. The thing is, if the optional assignment doesn't last for more than 20 days, the player gets credit for all those 20 days that he spent in the minors anyway. You basically have to burn an option in order to avoid the player getting credit for his optional assignment. And that's so teams don't do these things where they manipulate the service time without really missing the player in action. Like, you know, if we were talking about the Dodgers or whatever, like, they have such a division lead. In theory, they could send down Bellinger and Seager and, you know, play the service time game in a very cynical way. But in practice, it's harder to do that because they do have to stay in the minors for more than 3 weeks in order to avoid giving them that service time. So I think he's absolutely going to get the 9 days required to get him to over a year. And I don't know. I don't know if he's going to miss the 20 days necessary for him to miss any service time whatsoever.
Yeah, I kind of would advocate for leaving him down for 20 days, but not for the roster manipulation issues, the service time issues, more just for getting him in a good place. And if you really are going to give Camargo an extended look, as, you know, maybe he could be a piece for you, or maybe he's going to be the replacement for Brandon Phillips at second base next year, I do understand giving him some run. But yeah, this just doesn't seem like, well, I mean, I wouldn't mind burning an option on Dansby Swanson because I don't think he's going to be, I don't think his options are going to be an issue going forward. Like, you're not going to really, if you expect that you're going to be sending him down in 2018 and 2019, then you need to probably start looking at some other shortstop options.
Yes.
But, you know, he's also not necessarily the type of player who's going to make them regret it in arbitration. He might be a foundational player for this team, but the Braves can work around that. They have a good history of signing guys to extensions when they want to sign guys to extensions. So I'm not stressing out over that.
I agree with that. And yeah, I mean, minor league season lasts for what, 4 more weeks. So you can send him down, justify it for a month, bring him back when the minor league season ends. It's not a big deal. I understand why people say it, but not every demotion to a well-known young player is to play the service time game. And I think that rule is often overlooked when we talk about these things. You know, if you're sending a guy down for 10 to 15 days, it's not actually affecting them any. You know, they're just getting that service time in a different way. So, you know, that's one of my pet peeves, that and people saying DFA'd, or writing DFA'd, because the D is literally in the DFA. So stop doing that. Stop doing that, people.
Editor RJ comes out and RJ's.
Yeah, and if you want to hear more of Editor RJ, I actually just did Eric Roseberry's podcast with Sam Miller. We broke down a Zach Kreiser piece, where Zach Kreiser has been a co-host on the show. Before we broke down his piece anyway, I'm sure he's refusing the assignment from now on. So give that a listen if you're interested in Editor RJ.
Yeah, yeah. Also, if the Braves really cared that much about Dansby Swanson's service time, they probably wouldn't have brought him up last year.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, or they would have found a way to not have him be their starting shortstop to begin this season. Although I guess his play kind of forced the hand. You know, that franchise, you want to get as much good PR as possible moving into a new ballpark. And imagine if they had sent Swanson down for, like, whatever the Eric Ibar equivalent was, you know, whoever they could have gotten on, like, a 1-year, near league minimum deal to play shortstop, it probably would have been, Eric Hybar, someone of that ilk, right?
Former Brave Eric Hybar, who was so bad for them, so terrible.
And I agree with what you're saying, RJ. The only reason I brought it up was because I'm always cynical of teams trying to play these games. And I mean, if they wanted to truly do this, they would have sent him down like mid-July. Then you would have a reasonable argument to say that even if he was a September call-up, he wouldn't get to that year mark. But yeah, I mean, like you said, I think when the season ends, I think calling him back up as a September call-up would be smart, just because I think not giving him that pressure of being on the major league roster might help. I mean, I'm not someone who knows that for sure, but at the same time, I think that having him back up as a September call-up would make sense for them if he doesn't absolutely go out and tear up the world in his shortest stint.
I would know, but they seemingly waited until they got Sean Rodriguez back before they made this move too. So I wonder if this was just a case where maybe they had designs of sending Swanson down, but they were like, you know, to do so means leaning on Danny Santana more, which is never a good idea. I mean, for one thing, he's a small dude, so if you lean on him too much, he's going to fall over and you're going to fall over with him. But in addition to that, you know, you don't want to have to call up like Chase Darnot or whatever utility infielder is a passer in that system at this point. I don't even know, but yeah, I wonder if they were just like, you know what, let's just give him the extra few weeks until Rodriguez is back. Rodriguez has only been back for 9 games at this point, so what, 8 before Swanson was demoted. That way you have a veteran utility infielder who can slot in at second base, who can slot in at shortstop if need be, and that kind of takes the pressure off the roster, because, you know, that's an under-discussed aspect when you're moving a utility player into a full-time role, is you lose that versatility, and you're almost always getting worse in terms of your plan B at other positions. So Rodriguez should, in theory, and I'm a Sean Rodriguez fan, so maybe I'm just, you know, giving him too much credit here, but should, in theory, give them an upgrade overall if you believe that Camargo is actually this good, which there's no reason to believe that, actually. So never mind. The point, though, is I think it was probably not a coincidence that they sent down Swanson after they got Rodriguez back. I do, however, think it's a coincidence that they also demoted Aaron Blair on the same day they demoted Dansby Swanson. And, you know, why would we make that connection, Brian, between Swanson and Blair?
I don't know. I mean, it certainly isn't because they were traded in the same deal for missing Shelby Miller. Blair has been so not what we expected him to be since coming over. I mean, he was like the top prospect from the Diamondbacks non-Dansby Swanson division in that, you know, before that trade. And I've looked long and hard into Aaron Blair, and what I've seen is not good, friends. It is.
He's looking to the abyss.
Get out.
Aaron Blair, the abyss. And yeah, and the interesting thing is that it's not just in the majors he's been worse. It's overall. You know, when he was traded, he was coming off a season that he split between double and triple A. He had a 2.92 ERA over 26 appearances, 25 of those being starts. Well, last season in the minors, his walk rate shot up more than 1 walk per 9. His strikeout rate was basically the same, but his triple A strikeout to walkout ratio was 2.22 last year. In the majors, it went down to 1.35 this season, barely pitched in the majors. So you think, okay, you know, he got his foothold back in the minors. You know, he's back to being good. In 18 starts, he had a 4.86 ERA and a 1.7 strikeout to walk ratio. So he's actively gotten worse in Triple A. Strikeout rate is down. His walk rate has actually moved up. He's giving up more home runs. Hit rate is barely down. So this dude has been a mess since coming over, and it almost makes me wonder, what did the Braves do to him?
Yeah, he's borked. I have no idea if he's really – it's that the Braves did anything to him so much as it's just like this happens to some guys. Like, they lose their feel for control sometimes. It could be mechanical. It could be psychological. It could be lots of different things. It could be pitching with an injury for the last 2 years. I don't have any good – ideas to what it is that's causing his ineffectiveness, but it just it's unfortunate. I mean, the Braves still won the trade by a lot, but between him and Whistler and some of these other guys that they brought over in these trades, they really haven't had a whole lot of success with this crop of young pitchers that they were expecting to really be dynamic parts of their future rotation, Mike Foltynewicz accepted.
Right. I mean, you can even expand this a little bit. In addition to Whistler, by mentioning Newcomb, who I watched Newcomb's first start and I was like, oh, I see why he gets John Lester comparisons. You know, the delivery looked real easy. And, you know, 8 starts into his career now, he's walking nearly 5/9. He's giving up a home run per 9. The strikeouts are there, but I mean, he's basically exactly what you would feared he would become, which is a dude who's not missing enough bats. Excuse me, a dude who's missing the strike zone too often. He's also a little too hittable for your comfort level, and that's a bad combination. There is one young pitcher I'm going to mention here that they've had some success with, albeit in a small sample size, just because you both probably are very fond of him. Akil Morris, in 7 appearances, has struck out 11 batters per 9 and has a 1.23 ERA. What is your favorite Akil Morris moment, folks?
My favorite Akil Morris moment was not when he was traded to the Braves, although that was up there. It was, I think Keith Law had him as like his sleeper prospect for the Mets, as a guy who could be like a real breakout end of game reliever. I want to say it was like 2014 or 2015. And it got me real excited, really, really excited about Akil Morris. And that was a huge mistake. He pitched 52 pitches on Wednesday. That's kind of surprising to me. Like, that's a long time to let that guy go. But hey, you know, go for it, Braves. Do your thing.
Do y'all remember who Akil Morris was traded for in order to get to the Braves? I mean,
it was Kelly Johnson, right?
It was Kelly Johnson. See, Grosnick has this unlocked. He is your Akil Morris fan.
I'm on that transaction analysis beat every day, so I know my Kelly Johnson moves.
I am praying for you. What's your favorite part of a transaction analysis beat? I mean, your least favorite part, even.
Wow. Those are tough questions, and we don't have much time left for the show. My favorite part is when I get a move that I get to write up, and I don't have anything good to say about it, so I try to be a little bit creative, and it works out. That happens very infrequently, because most of the time when I try to get creative, it does not work for me at all. But, you know, finding these little guys, backup catchers, I always like watching the backup catcher carousel go around. So those are my dudes, because you almost always have something to talk about with a backup catcher, either their history or their, you know, experiences pitching, or, you know, what the circle of, you know, 10 different teams that Eric Kratz plays for in a different season. So that's kind of my favorite. My least favorite is actually having to write them.
That makes sense. And the part I miss the most is writing about Don Roach. He's one of those little guys we talked about, except when you shine the light on him, he tends to scurry underneath the bed. So that'll probably do it.
yep, we're in the bad news portion of the show.
Yes. Thank you for listening, everyone.
You can find our show at DFA Podcast on Twitter. You can find all of our show posts on baseballperspectives.com. You can find RJ at CBS Sports all the time as we lead into the deadline. You can find Sean at BP Mets at Beyond the Box Score, where he is consistently turning out good work. And you can find me at Baseball Perspectives. So thank you all for listening. If you get around to it, a rating or a review on iTunes would be lovely, but you know, only if you feel deeply in your heart that these jokes are worth reviewing positively, which, you know, good for you if that's the case. But on behalf of RJ and Sean, thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.